plenty of time for questions.
Yeah, thank you very much for these two lectures. I have one comment and maybe one question. The first comment is about your talk. You said that there is no theory. As an economist, I must say there is a theory that puts the shareholder value maximization into the center, but the theory doesn't match reality. So it's the theory consists of a combination of economic rationality, so each economic agent is just maximizing utility or expected utility, and complete financial markets, in the sense that you have as many assets with independent returns as you have states of the world. And in such a world, you can just construct a riskless portfolio, and you can show with a little bit of mathematics that in such a world, each economic agent wants the shareholder value maximized, the shareholder value unanimity, and in such a world, of course, it would be the right thing to do so. But once, if you give up the assumption of complete financial markets, so we, in reality, we do not have as many financial assets with independent returns, everything gets lost. And in order to have something to stick to, economists, they measure every deviation from this ideal world, which still remains to act as a benchmark for economists, by agency costs. So this is the reason, and this is also why Vishni, Schleifer, and so on, they try to save the model by saying, well, if we reduce these agency costs, and that is, if we manage to overcome information asymmetry, then we get closer to the world of complete financial markets, and we can save the model with shareholder value maximization as a property or as a good way to achieve Pareto efficiency in such a world. And of course, I'm an economist, but I don't support this view. This is a wrong view. And this... I'd like to comment on the second paper and pose a question, because if we deviate from this model, if we deviate first from economic rationality, and if we deviate from financial market completeness because we have fundamental uncertainty, then we come to contract cultures, because we have to somehow stabilize expectations, and we can do that by institutions, and institutions rely on contracts, and this is what the stakeholder model is relying on. It's a relational contract culture which helps to stabilize and which helps to introduce a long-termism in contrast to a myopia.
Well, of course there's a theory. But look at what's going on. They connect agency cost reduction to the market price given information asymmetry. You can talk about reducing information asymmetry all you want, but if you want to play this game, you have to get rid of it first, which is why my contention is they don't have a theory. Okay? They don't have closure. And this is,
they don't have an appropriate theory. I would like to add.
I accept the modification, okay? To read the law reform literature that is economically inspired is to be very impressed by an unwillingness to confront the underlying economics directly, okay? They just skirt over it and assume that it's there.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Well, I definitely prefer the reality-based economics. I think we get a lot more from looking at game theory to some degree, behavioral economics. I try to understand real markets. I don't know why we have to start with an unreal market in order to understand a real market, and I think that's the way I look at it. And I think that unfortunately, the neoclassical economic theory has led us down a garden path, and I think it's created a lot of a lot of problems, and so I think it's really, really important that we move away from that theory. On the other hand, I mean, I believe in power, and I think that's one of the reasons why I'm not ready to fully divorce myself from the shareholder model, because that's right now the only power in the society that counters managerial power is shareholder power. On the other hand, I do think it is being misused and needs to be reined in to some degree, or at least some of these shareholders.
I think if you want to disempower managers, the best way to do that is to regulate them substantively.
Well, maybe certainly I would agree in trying to strengthen fiduciary obligations. We now have, you know, the business judgment rule, which in essence just defers to management in terms of the way that in terms of their decision making. So maybe we might want to hold them to a negligence standard, let's say, rather than what seems to be happening today, in which we have to show intent.
No, I would say don't borrow above a certain level, and if they go ahead and do it, you line them up and shoot them.
I find this conversation, post-presentation conversation, much more reasonable in a way than the formal presentations. And the reasons are, and there's a, I notice there's a huge contrast, because the debate in corporate governance issues seems to be framed in terms of extremes.
Of what?
Extremes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I may use an architectural metaphor, it's as if we are debating whether buildings made out of wood or steel are better, or concrete or brick, which is better. The fact is, virtually all buildings we like to live and work in today have composites of various kinds. Different architects may design these buildings in different materials in different places, and there are thousands, if not millions and billions, of different ways of designing them, because there's not only a very large number of variables, but there are extremely most uncountable number of interactions among those variables. So the architects don't go around taking out a brick out of the building and measuring the stability of the building and then saying, well, bricks don't matter, because look, I took this brick out, it didn't make any difference to stability of the building, and so on and so forth. And that's what a lot of our accounting and finance and corporate governance, the statistical literature that you referred to, basically does correlations. There's no causality there ever. So we have to be very careful about that. So what I'm sort of wondering is, are these debates going to be about changes on the margin? After all, it is not the case that shareholders have no rights, or that managers have all the rights, or vice versa. In fact, managers' rights are quite limited in various ways, and so are shareholder rights. And you can see that in the evolution of the early corporations in the beginning of the 17th century, at least, how these corporations struggled with attempts to try to define and try to balance these things. But why are we back at this black and white debate?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because one of the things that's happening in the corporate literature is, you know, people are arguing, well, should we have director primacy or should we have shareholder primacy? And you're thinking, well, you need them both, you know, for the system really to work. So I think that's a good question in terms of, you know, where it's going to go. I wrote an article some years ago on the power coalition model, and I think that in essence it's going to go in accordance to power. You know, I think that's what's going to happen here to some degree. But I think what we can do, you know, in being a little more optimistic, is to look at problems. In other words, what are the problems that we have here, and how can, and are they can we document that this is in fact a problem? And I think one of the things that Bill is saying is, you know, I don't see some problems, right? So the question is, do we have a problem here? Is there a problem with short-termism, for example? And then what is the best way of dealing with that particular problem? You know, what is this manifestation? Why is it occurring? And then are there things that we can do, you know, maybe incrementally to make a change? Because as you say, to make a dramatic change, you're forgetting all of the other good things, the reason why we have to begin with.
If I may, either we take the view that there's a problem or there isn't a problem, or we take a view that on the margin there's an improvement to be made.
Yes.
These are two very different points of view approaching the problem. And what I was saying was that presentations went, there's a problem, there isn't a problem, and our conversation seems to be going the other way, which is obviously my
Well, of course, with the economic crisis, that's sort of like a real big problem, you know. So I think we make an improvement. Yes, please, you know.
I didn't see our paper as a paper that's a black to a white or a white to a black. We're simply saying that we have an inherited legal regime that is capacious. It has many problems. It accommodates all kinds of different governance structures. Okay, all kinds. But there are a couple of hard lines that it draws. All right, that's it. And it's not even first best, second best. It's much worse than that. All right. So lots of problems. All we're saying is we think you would just make it somewhat worse if you instituted certain reforms to give shareholders direct inputs into business policymaking. That's it. That we think there could be benefits to that, but that the discussion omits confrontation with costs, okay, for reasons that are variegated. There are all kinds of reasons why people don't want to admit that empowering shareholders implies costs. Some of them are political, some of them are economic, all kinds of reasons. We're just insisting that both sides of the cost-benefit balance be confronted. That's all. That's the paper.
Is the point a historically contingent point in the sense that at this particular moment, given this particular configuration with these possible constraints and imagining everything as it exactly as it is, it would be a bad idea? Or are you making some broader claim about the structure of the court? And if you are, then don't you need to either take on the agency theory or the property theory at root? I mean, again, you sort of seem like you're dancing around
the deck.
I don't know. I'm asking.
Historically, okay, I don't think it would have been plausible to suggest shareholder empowerment 50 years ago for all kinds of economic reasons. Okay, it just wouldn't have made any sense. It is plausible to suggest that today, due to the shift to institutional stockholding. Okay, so if you just take a broad view and say, let's take the world since 1990, this is the first moment, at least in the history of this country, at which shareholder power plausibly can be mooted. So it's a new question. Okay, taking a broad view. Methodologically, the paper is self-consciously set up to stay within the traditional financial economics. Okay, that's a self-conscious choice, partly because I have a collaborator who refuses to see anything any other way, and partly because I think that you can take traditional financial economics, and if you read the economics, that is, take out Journal of Finance as opposed to reading, I don't know, law review articles from 20 years ago, you discover that traditional that financial economics is much more capacious than most people outside of the field believe it to be. Okay? It depicts markets as complicated places. It accepts market failure. Okay, It is tractable for people who are concerned with the real world. Okay, you don't need behaviorism to market to depict markets plausibly. Okay, you can do it out of Journal of Finance. So but you can also go to behaviorism. Okay, it's just a matter of methodological choice. We chose the most conservative methodological framework because we think so doing strengthens the case.
If I have understood well, your question is arguing in the following way. Shareholders can do nothing because of information asymmetry between management and shareholders.
Can I qualify that? If you're talking about an institutional blockholder on the continent of Europe, that's a different case as far as we're concerned.
But there's one remedy against informational asymmetries, and this is disclosure transparency about financial conditions, about prospects, about management performance, and so on. In the last 50, 60 years, we have seen that the volume of disclosure rules and disclosure regulations has inflated, with the US going ahead and European countries, for example, following. And now there's a question, what's our opinion, what's your opinion about the level reach of disclosures of financial position, of level reach of accounting rules, is it too much? Is it not too much? Is there a certain tendency, a certain buffer that can be used by lawmakers, regulators to decrete even more transparency? There is a risk in more transparency, and this is in the German literature, for example, associated with the motive of myopia. This is the motive of myopia. In the German literature of the 70s, 80s, early 90s, it was often argued that more frequent, more frequent disclosures and more transparency can lead to short-termism, to managers being built to reach short-term aims. What's your opinion?
I think the objection you raise is a valid one, that the cumbersome mandatory disclosure system that we have in this country, which is backed up by criminal penalties and plaintiffs' lawyers, could indeed be suboptimally excessive and could indeed contribute to short-termism. Because the paper turns on information asymmetry, I spent a while in preparing it, looking to see if I could find an economic literature that modeled optimal disclosure and it at least gave me some hard lines. And what I found was very amorphous. And I did not find any of the economists doing in the literature taking the step of then saying, I think the regulatory regime we have is excessive or not. Okay, there certainly is a free market school out there that says if you just simply leave the companies and the actors in the marketplace to their own devices, that market pressures will cause managers to disclose more, maybe perhaps, than they would want to, and that there'll be some back and forth. But that, for various reasons, your relationships with your competitors, your relationships with your regulators, there are all kinds of reasons why full disclosure should never be expected from a rational manager. Okay, so I think your objection is potentially powerful, but I didn't find anything, I didn't find that in the literature I reviewed, and I think it's a missing point in the literature I reviewed.
One thing that a number of companies...
There's a lot of work done on this, and it's not even based on behavioral economics or behavioral limitations. And perfectly rational models have been shown extensively, very large to shown this, and that could be the reference.
Shown what in particular?
That transparency for transparency does not lead to optimal decisions.
I'd be interested in the citations.
So because, and we can ask ourselves, you know, which of us would like to live and work in a glass house? And why not? I mean, if my dean walks into my office and says, Sean, we're going to put you in a glass walled office. What? You know, what's the problem? What do you do in your office that you don't want other people to see? Nothing, you don't. But I do. I mean, I take a nap in the afternoon. I lean back and close my eyes for 15 minutes. I'm good for the 3 hours. That's good for me. That's good for the school.
Now, interestingly...
But I would not do it in a glass house.
Over the last 50 years, yes. It has been shown that stock price movements have shifted from being market-wide movements, like capital asset pricing model market-wide movements, to being... movements due to company-specific information. Okay? That is, the level of information about companies available to the market and the market's responsiveness to information about particular companies has increased many-fold. Okay? Are we at an excessive level? You know, nice question.
We have the makeup, you know. We have makeup, you know. Would you pay any attention to the makeup? Would you just think about what's this person like behind the makeup? If so, why do they wear makeup?
Yeah, there were a number of companies, including major companies such as Coca-Cola, Alcoa, AT&T, and Sun Microsystems, that did discontinue reporting quarterly earnings figures, guidance to curtail short-termism. You know, the whole idea was, and to allow them to focus on long-term corporate performance. And the most recent study on this has found that it resulted in a decrease in long-term capital expenditures and R&D after the stoppage. The study found that the firms in the study did not increase their disclosure of forward-looking disclosures, which, you know, in terms of what they were planning to do for the long term. And it also found that that the major reason for the stoppage of earnings management was poor firm performance. So I'm not, you know, but there's another study that found a slightly differently on this subject that it had some positive effects. But that certainly discouraged me from recommending that we have less information out there in order to counter, you know, myopia or whatever. In fact, I think, as you know, has been mentioned, informational asymmetry is really at the heart of myopia, and so I certainly wouldn't want to increase that that asymmetry.
I have a question. It is just about delegations of management, because some people say that maybe it is another reason of myopia and short-termism. And maybe, as you talk about institutional investors, a way to reduce their mimetism is just to give the right to pensioner, for instance, or to people to decide about the allocations of portfolio. Because now you could have, so in the United States, pension fund who have delegations to a professional mutual fund, and after they will choose to invest in hedge fund or in very activist hedge fund or in LBO or everything. And sometimes there is a contrary between pension fund who have the right about their retirement, and after some time, the use of this capital who could destroy their own firm. So I think that the problem is that you stop a linear relation between saver and investor by delegations, and you create opacity between the true owner of capital and savings and the users of this capital. So maybe a way is just to reduce and just to say what you have in your portfolio, do you want that or do you want other things?
Right. You know, it struck me one thing that, I have no idea, in my pension fund, what the turnover rate of stocks is, I think there is some information that I think, and it is a public information, but you have to look it up, I think, forms with the SEC, but certainly I think more information, I think we need to know a little bit more about what the fund managers are doing.
And just for you, so in fact, the real shareholder are not the, it is just some financial intermediaries. And I think that that is a problem because...
Are you suggesting that institutional investors might be irresponsible?
No, I don't say that. I just say just to give back the right to allocate as you want.
Right. In other words, you're really raising the issue of the agency costs associated with the intermediary. Mm. And that's a big issue.
Actually,
that really is a big
issue. Adolf Berling talked about that 50 years ago. Mm.
What about a rule that said investors or shareholders cannot be transient shareholders? Either one that gets there that says you've got to hold it for a year or 2 years. I understand you've got liquidity. Here.
There's some economists who are talking about that kind of a model.
Or one that takes Rubin's ideas from the morning and just uses
totally
corporate tax to do it.
So you have a capital gains tax, and the tax rate decreases the longer you hold the stock.
Right.
And so it gives you the incentive to hold on that stock a longer time.
But that's probably not enough incentive.
You opt into a stockholding mode that gets you accreting votes as your holding period lengthens.
But I wonder to what extent your institutional investors pay taxes.
As an investor, I also want to keep the option of firing the rascals who are running company because I'm not sure that they're any good.
I mean, clearly,
the
this imposes some
moment restrictions on me about the term of investment holding period, I'm logged in.
Right.
And to that extent, you're basically transferring more power to the manager.
You know, there's the other issue of, should we deprive people of the opportunity of gain from high-frequency trading? I mean, we saw the drop in stock price dramatically on, May 6th. But on the other hand, if they're representing my pension fund, maybe I'd like them to do it because Congress have found that, this kind of momentum trading is actually quite profitable.
But is there a real social utility in it, I guess?
Yeah, that's just it.
No.
It doesn't seem to be much social utility because it is a zero-sum game. Somebody's winning, someone's losing. So,
It seems to me if we think that short-term trading is a great example, but even short-term shareholding is causing us more problems than we're getting out of it, then why not limit it? Understand, yes, there'll be some limitation on the front end and something else to think about when I make...
These arguments are very parallel to the shorting arguments, or arguments against shorting.
Yeah.
After all, they also provide a social service.
Yeah.
So, Ruben, if we decrease capital gains tax pro rata with the holding period, would that be a corporate tax behavioral intervention, or would that be a personal income tax behavioral intervention?
Personally, I guess, but your data is very telling in that slide. There's a huge increase of repurchases just at the moment.
Well, there's a tax explanation there.
But it's irrational because this is just when we reduce the tax on dividends and this thing takes off. So why is that? That makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, my reaction to that is that you're underclaiming in the article. meaning
of things.
There's a lot of evidence that you bring forward that there's too few agency costs now, and that, you know, there's all of these hedge funds stuff, and so because that's the explanation for these repurchases. I mean, it's the managers now acting in, you know, in ways that benefit the shareholders, and given all these.
Right, between the tax change and the hedge funds, you have a pretty good explanation.
Well, yeah, exactly. And given that, then maybe we should start talking about lower firm in the opposite direction, which is what I guess we would be
doing. You know, it's sort of like that. You know, they're really using the companies as the opportunity for short-term arbitrage. And, you know, that's really what's going on. And they're saying, okay, if we can change the investment policy of this company, make it a little more short-term, we're going to get some return on that. And so why don't we have them repurchase our stock? Hey, and the way we'll do it is we'll finance it. We'll finance that with this debt. And so that's a lot of what's going on. And I agree with Bill. I think it's really problematic. And it's part of this myopia that's occurring. I'm just not sure that I think the logic of actually, Bill, although you poach your article and you know, not making a great change, but the logic leads you also to the conclusion, well, you know, do we want to have shareholders involved at all? And so what I'm trying to find is, you know, are there some shareholders we're more concerned about than others?
Well, your suggestion that somehow buy and hold fully diversified institutional investors have some kind of might have a particularly valuable input. I actually can't accept that because I don't think they know anything. That's why they're sort of fully diversified. They don't want to invest in information.
Actually, John Coffey talked about them, and there's been some other writing about them as, I'm trying to recall the name, what they use for these investors. But as you know, what they do is they rely on these institutional investor organizations to provide information on how they should vote on their shares. But you do have at least, and my feeling about this, about the notion of passive shareholders, because this has always been an argument, even when we didn't have institutional shareholders and we just had dispersed shareholders, everyone would say, we don't need any rules for shareholder voting because of their passivity. I said, but when there's a problem, when there's a serious problem, then you want people to have a mechanism by which they can exercise some sort of power. And, of course, the shareholder vote is an important mechanism. Now, we want to make sure it's in the right hands. But, you know, I'm of course, I've argued in the past for stakeholder theory as well. And I think that I'd like to actually think about employee participation. All methods of governance have their positives and negatives. But, you know, at this point in our history, and with the institutional investors and some of the short-termism that's going on, you know, I think there's a good argument to be made for also having employees on the board of directors.
Mm-hmm. We have that in
Germany. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's time for employee co-determination.
That's why I wanted to ask a question to your professors, why you focus on corporations and corporate governance, and obviously this is what you study, but the thing that's a little bit confusing to me is whether you're talking about a relationship between, a private relationship, mind you, between shareholders and managers, which is somehow being imposed upon and regulated by the state for some reasons. And the underlying implication is that somehow the state has a right to abrogate away that and take away from that private relationship and impose and effectively take away rights from shareholders and take away rights from managers and impose a whole other set of rights on parties that are not part of that relationship, as what you call stakeholders.
Well, I suppose you'd have to look at it a little bit historically, you know, and why shareholders got the right to vote. And you might find that there were a lot of political and power reasons for that, and not necessarily because it is consistent with some sort of notion of economic efficiency. Mm-hmm. And also I find it very hard to view the relationships between various constituencies in the company as being a pure contract. All of these relationships are embedded in business norms, notions of legitimacy, in a whole slew of laws that are impact those relationships, whether it's the relationship between employees, the companies, shareholders in the companies, or whatever. The reason we have share, I think, in the public company that we have this notion of shareholder as the owners, which has really been discredited by anybody who studies this area, but yet we have, of course, people arguing in favor of shareholder primacy, is really legitimacy. They legitimize management, right? And it wasn't a problem. Management didn't care about it when they were dispersed shareholders and they didn't do anything. And in fact, if you look at the SEC proposed rules, the proposals that are being made to allow shareholders to use the company's proxy statement to, propose a minority of directors, we've had proposals like that have gone back ages, and the SEC continuously would say, should we allow shareholders to do it? We can't see any other reason. After all, that's our legitimacy of corporation governance, is based on allowing shareholders to vote. Well, we let them vote, but we don't let them nominate directors. Does that really make sense? And every time the SEC will say, we can't see any argument against it, and then they wouldn't do anything about it and would disappear, because it was power. Management didn't want that power in shareholders. Now what's happening is we have, the institutional investors who do have power. And so now these kinds of proposals now to change the rule have a lot of a force behind them. And now we're saying, well, no, there's other reasons now that maybe we don't want to go in that direction. But then we have to start thinking about how do we legitimate managerial power.
It seems like you've dismissed 200 years of law, property law, because in fact the shareholders are the owners.
Oh, but they haven't been running public companies
for a long
time.
Not that they run it, but they own it.
They own the shares of legal entities.
Yeah.
And take what the law, whatever the law says the legal entity is what they have. Your argument carried one more step is that you can't regulate a corporation because you're depriving shareholders of property.
But I think, should we go back a little bit into the history of the origin of the corporation? Was it the case that these rights were given to the shareholders? Or the entrepreneurs got together, create businesses, and their entrepreneurial shares, partnerships expanded into a larger group of people? And then they brought in professional managers and gave them some rights. And that, over time, began to appear in law. So I think giving shareholder rights is the direction to think about, historically at least.
In this country, shareholder rights underwent a setback simultaneously with the appearance of mass production. That was when charter competition was invented in New Jersey in 1888, all right? The central thing, one of the central things that happened with that was the reversal of the shareholder rights that they're now trying to get back, all right? That is the right to initiate management policy, okay? That was taken away from the shareholders by New Jersey in 1888. Okay, and only after that did we have dispersed shareholding in the securities markets. That begins in World War One, early 1920s, and the American separation of ownership and control model develops against the background of shareholders who have had their legal wings clipped.
All right, on that note, thank you very much.